stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 104 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California is Andrew Brokus. How are you tonight, Andrew?
I'm doing very well. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Life is good. Weather's good. After a bout of the weather being bad and even with forecasts of more bad weather, life is good. You settling into San Francisco?
Getting there. My room is once again full of unpacked or partially unpacked boxes. After putting away the first round of things, the second round of things has arrived. And as you know, just before this recording started, I had to switch out my chairs. Right now I have two chairs that we bought from a salvage shop. One of them is like an old wooden chair that's much more comfortable, but it makes a lot of squeaking noises when I sit in it. So I figured not ideal for podcasting. And then I have like a plastic folding chair, which is less comfortable but doesn't make noise. So this is the sacrifices that I make for this show.
All right. Are you taking Uber everywhere yet?
No. Lately Uber has kind of a skeezy vibe around it anyway. But I'm trying to maintain good Nikkest behaviors. I've been doing a lot of public transit, which is decent in San Francisco. I mean, it's not New York, it's not even Boston, but it's not bad.
All right. Are you doing other characteristically San Franciscan things? Riding a bike everywhere?
No, I need to get a bike too. I don't know. I guess I'm not. I mean, I'm getting harassed pretty frequently. I live just a few blocks off of Hate Street, so I get offered to buy marijuana like several times a day, or people offer to sell me marijuana several times a day. that's certainly a very stereotypically Hate Street thing. I guess it's stereotypical for San Francisco in general. I don't remember when was the last day that I didn't like smell marijuana smoke. It's been a long time.
I see.
Probably since I came out here.
All right. Well, as long as you don't die riding a bicycle, I'm cool with any of that. So
I'm doing my best.
All right. So you've got a little speech here. Why don't you get into it?
Well, I do want to, to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and a happy Thanksgiving to our listeners as well, even those of who are not in the United States. I hope you found some opportunity to think about being thankful, if not on this day, then just in general. We certainly are thankful for everyone who listens to the show. We're thankful for those of you who have written to us with comments, with suggestions, stories, hands, strategy questions, all that kind of stuff. We are thankful for the people who have come to our meetups in Las Vegas and Atlantic City, and also to the people who have offered to meet up with us if we ever come out to their neck of the woods. I'm thankful to the people who specifically have reached out to me since I've moved to the Bay Area. I'm sorry that I haven't really taken any of you up on those offers yet. I certainly hope to get some free meals and beers at some point. I just have, I don't know, I've been some combination of lazy and busy. We are definitely thankful to the people who have supported the show financially. That includes Poker News for inviting us to be a part of their feed this year. It includes Tournament Poker Edge. It includes all of you who have purchased the premium podcasts. And it includes the folks who have used our Amazon affiliate link when shopping at Amazon. Speaking of which, when you are doing your holiday shopping this year, you can support the podcast in the process by using the Support the Podcast tab on the Thinking Poker website. So thinkingpoker.net, click on the Support the Podcast tab, and there are affiliate links there that will take you to the Amazon site that's appropriate for your country. So we've got affiliate links for .com, .ca, UK, FR, ES, IT. I think that's all of them that we have right now. And it won't cost you anything extra. But if you do your holiday shopping or any shopping that you're doing on Amazon through those affiliate links, Nate and I will get a bit of the money from that, which is nice.
Yeah, just try to make sure that they aren't raising the prices when you use the affiliate.
Yeah, that's right. We did have one person who wrote to us and thought he had some evidence or had one example of the prices being raised. As far as I understand, they're not supposed to be different prices.
Yeah. So...
I do also want to say that I'm thankful to everyone who is buying and reading my new series of books, The Thinking Poker Diaries. In case you have not heard yet, Volume 2 of The Thinking Poker Diaries is on sale now. That's a trip report from the 2007 World Series of Poker main event, recounting both key hands from the tournament as well as entertaining anecdotes about my opponents. It includes strategy essays in which present-day Andrew reflects on what 2007 Andrew got right and wrong. My hope is that you will find it both educational and entertaining, and at $2.99, I don't think you can really go wrong getting yourself a copy of that, which you can get from knitcast.com or from the Kindle store on Amazon. And finally, I think that you will be grateful if you subscribe to Tournament Poker Edge and give yourself the gift of tournament success this holiday season. TPE's Stable of Pros, which does include yours truly, can provide you with valuable insights into all aspects of tournament play, from pre-flop strategy to post-flop hand reading and everything in between. Treat yourself or your poker buddies to a subscription to Tournament Poker Edge, starting as low as $25 per month. It's a rare gift that can actually pay for itself. Now there's something to be thankful for. So for this week, I think I know that we do not have a guest lined up, so we are going to be running through a couple of different strategy questions that have been sent to us. Some of them are theoretical, some of them deal with specific hands, but as you know, I'm sure we'll find a way to draw out some theoretical questions from the specific hands. Do you want to read this first one from Chris?
Sure. Chris says, "Hi, Andrew and Nate. I played in a very large live tournament in the UK. The biggest ever outside of the US with over 3,000 players. It was a deep stacked multi-day event with a buy-in of only £120, approximately $200, and a price pool of over £300,000, or $500,000. As you might imagine, this event attracted a huge number of very inexperienced players who wanted to sample a big live tournament, and during my time in the tournament, I witnessed one of the players exhibit my favorite tell ever. He was a young guy, quite possibly playing live for the first time ever, and he was sitting directly to my left. Throughout the day so far, he'd always had his phone close to hand and appeared to be either tweeting or texting regularly between hands. In the hand in question, we were both in late position, me in the hijack, him in the cutoff. As soon as he'd had his second card dealt to him, he looked at his hand, placed his cards face down for the briefest of pauses, and then picked up his phone and tried to surreptitiously take a photo of his whole cards. I'm not sure whether he had succeeded in doing so by the time the action got to him, but when it did, he was facing an early position raise. He re-raised, everyone folded, and he proudly displayed his aces to the table. If anyone else at the table noticed what he did, then they kept it quiet about it as it wasn't mentioned at all, and the player didn't do it again before he was eliminated a little later. However, if I had seen him do it again, then it would have been the first time ever in my poker career when I'd have been tempted to open fold kings pre-flop. Keep up the good work. The podcast is reliably excellent every week. All the best, Chris." Thanks, Chris, both for the compliment and for the amusing story.
Yeah, that's a good bit of strategy advice there. If you get dealt pocket aces, I mean, you can wait until after the hand is over to take your picture. You don't have to do it before the preflop action is finished.
It's true. So would you really fold kings the second time? So the guy just wanted a picture of himself holding aces. Like, if he takes the picture the second time, I'm not sure there's any... Like, I think it's a strong hand. I'm not sure I would fold kings, though. What would you do?
I'd be more tempted to fold the kings the first time. I think you're right. Like, why would he want a second picture of his... Yeah, he could have just taken two the first time if he wanted another picture of pocket aces.
I almost think, like, it would be 7-6 suited or handler. You
know, yeah, like his favorite hand.
Yeah, or... Yeah, right. The hand he busted his buddy with the week before, and then he wants to text it to him. Yeah, I'm not sure I would make that tight a fold, but
that's
a
good story regardless.
Yeah, an excellent observation. You gotta hand it to him. And he wrote in. That's great. He said nice things about us. That's nice. Yeah, you want to read this next one from David?
Yeah, this is somewhat more purely a strategy question. David writes to us from Colorado, where he describes that the law requires a maximum bet of $100. So all of the cash games there, the most that you can bet on any street is $100, and then raises are considered separately. So if someone bets 50, you could raise to 150, but not to 151. He says, "I'm winning consistently these days in the 1-2 game and want to move up a level. Could you discuss some of the mathematical implications of the spread limit version of the game? What adjustments would you make for a 1-2 spread limit versus no limit? What about if the blinds were 2-5? I'm sure the larger blinds mean the game will play like limit poker earlier in the hand than 1-2, and I'd love to hear what adjustments you'd make in this situation." So I don't have any experience actually playing Spread Limit. Have you ever played it?
I've played so much Spread Limit in my life. I lived in Arizona in 2007. So not only have I played hundreds of hours of Spread Limit. Yeah, hundreds? A lot of hours. At least 100. I actually wrote probably my best received 2+2 magazine article was on Spread Limit Poker. It was answering this exact question. So
I actually didn't know. I mean, I sort of knew the Arizona thing, but I think in retrospect, it's going to sound like a setup that I was like, so Nate, have you ever played Spread Limit Poker?
Well, as it happens, Andrew, I'm a recognized authority from back when we generally agree nobody knew much of anything about poker. So that's, yeah. So two things that that David says are both correct. As the blinds get very small relative to the cap, the game plays more like No Limit. And as the blinds get large relative to the cap, it plays more like Limit. Although it plays more like Fixed Limit, not the limit structures we're used to with the double bets on either the turn and river or 5th, 6th, and 7th Street. And it's actually quite important that it's like that. The double bets in Limit games really have an important function. It lets you fold sometimes. Like there will be cases sometimes when the pot gets really juiced. If it plays more like Fixed Limit Poker, you just have to call down with anything. Whereas in Limit Hold'em, the fact that the turn bet is double sized means you can fold sometimes. So
wait, hold on. I have an embarrassing admission. I didn't realize that Fixed Limit was different from just Limit. I always use those two terms interchangeably.
Oh, okay. I mean, when I learned those terms, Fixed Limit meant, the same bet all the time.
Like $2, $4 blinds, and every single bet is $4. There's never an $8 bet.
Yeah, that's right. So at Yale back in the day, I never played in this game, but rumor had it there was a $2 Fixed Limit game. Or Straight Limit. That's the word I'm thinking of. Straight Limit, I think. Anyway, nobody plays these games. I've even forgotten what the term is. Fixed Limit means limit, and there's some other term for this thing that nobody ever plays, but Spread Limit sometimes approximates to. And, so if there's $700 in the pot and it's $100 bets all the way down, it's going to be correct to call with a lot of hands. Not all of them, but more than it would be if it was like $500 to call down, right? 100 plus 200 plus 200 instead of 100 plus 100 plus 100. So this has a few implications. One is that people often aren't really... So it's correct to play pretty loose and aggressive in limit games. So especially in a 2-5 game with $100 max, some people will not actually want to play properly. So you can often inflate the pot and then take it down with a bet that'll be like, even if it's a $400 pot, you can make a $100 bet and get too many folds. And if you're against opponents like that, you can inflate the pot early to accomplish that. So that's one strategic adjustment you can make. Other than that, I mean, there are the implied odds differences where you can't, like, if you're sitting with 1500 and there's like $100 in the pot, you can't call for, you can't call with a gut shot planning to get paid off huge later because there's no huge bet to make. And that's something, like, it feels a bit like No Limit, and often the game attracts No Limit players and has a No Limit vibe, but some of these implied odds hands really do go down in value just because you can't get the big bets paid off. Also, being out of position can be less bad, especially if the pot's a little bit inflated. And oftentimes, if it's a limpy game, there's often going to be, $50 to $100 in the pot going into the flop. And then there are only three streets left, and the bets just aren't going to be that big. So those are some of the things to think about. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, because of the same point, that the pot can't grow geometrically in the same way that it can in No Limit. I think that I would imagine it's correct to do a bit more slow playing in this game, or that slow playing is a little bit safer. One of the things that happens in No Limit is when you slow play, like if you have a hand that you could have gotten paid off on three streets, but instead you check the flop, you don't really miss out on the first bet. You miss out on the third bet, right? Because you end up putting in two bets instead of three. And the third bet, because the pot has grown as a result of the first two bets, is the largest. So you end up missing out on potentially a very large bet if you only get two streets out of a hand that you could have gotten three streets from. So, you know, in a 2-5 game, that might mean, depending on how deep you are, and I think that's one consequence of these spread limit games, people probably don't tend to play that deep either. But, you know, if you happen to be in a spread limit game where even if you had like $1,500 behind, there just wouldn't be an opportunity on the river to bet $500 or $600 the way there could be in a 2-5 game with the same, a 2-5 no limit game with the same stacks, which means that the consequences of not having built the pot on the flop are not as severe. You're no longer missing out on a $500 bet on the river. You're missing out on a $100 bet on the river. So the downside to slow playing, I imagine, is not going to be quite what it would be in a no limit game.
Yeah, that's very true. You also have to sometimes reach into your limit bag of tricks to price somebody out. So if the pot's you know, maybe $100 or $200, it can be correct to check raise, just to especially on once it gets to the turn. If you really want to price out a draw, and you can't just run somebody off like a flush draw, let's say, just by betting the max. And this can be true even on the turn. So sometimes you risk the free card, both because the free card isn't that bad, and also because facing somebody with the $200 bet or with the $160 bet or whatever the max you can make it is, sometimes that's the only way to price out the opponent. So it's a fun hybrid. I guess the one thing I say in the article is here's the algorithm a lot of people use to play spread limit is pretend it's no limit, except if you want to make a bet bigger than $100, just reduce it to $100. people do that a lot. It's a bad algorithm. You have to think ahead and you have to realize that the game has this hybrid structure. The big bets aren't there, so it changes position, it changes the value of hands, changes what you have to do to protect your hand, to get value from your hand, makes some plays better, other plays worse. And, you know, just a consequence of multi-street thinking is that you can't use this sort of naive algorithm to play spread limit.
We actually have a second strategy question from David. I guess we're feeling generous this week. Often when people write us with more than one question, we just pick our favorite, but I happen to like both of these. So David also asked, my second strategy question concerns Sklansky's theory of poker. Recognizing that profit comes from getting better hands to fold and worse hands to call, we capitalize on that by bluffing or semi-bluffing and by value betting respectively. I'm working on continuation betting and bluffing scare cards against nits more often to capitalize on the former. But regarding the latter, one thing I realized listening to your show is that I've been letting worse hands off the hook by transmitting the strength of my hand through large bets. I've concluded that making worse hands fold is a serious leak of mine. Until recently, I often bet with two pair in sets because I feared turns and rivers would let my opponents draw out on me. I also had a swing for the fences approach that I picked up somewhere along the way, where I was betting big and hoping my opponent had something to call with. But hope is not a strategy, and I didn't put too much thought into estimating their range or hand strength, which cost me some profit I might have captured later in the hand. Now I'm trying to do better by letting flops go unbet when I think my opponent is weak and trying to make up for it on the turn and river. That's unless I think they're strong or on a draw and willing to call a big bet, in which case I do try to get money in on the flop. Can you please discuss more strategies and betting lines for getting worse hands to call? What do you consider when trying to keep worse hands from folding? Well, first off, I think people on this show have probably heard me or read me talking quite a bit about the concept of value targeting, and David does allude to it here. And you know, the basic idea is that even when you're value betting, you still want to have some idea of what kind of hand you think your opponent is likely to have, and in what ways he's going to be willing to put money into the pot with that hand. So, you know, the other thing that David sort of hints at is he kind of suggests that he knows when his opponent is weak or when his opponent is strong. And that's certainly valuable information. I mean, if you actually have legitimate reason to believe that your opponent is weak, then slow playing will very often be correct, even in situations where it doesn't generally seem like it would be. So, you know, I would often think that you wouldn't want to check a hand like pocket sevens on a 5-6-7 flop, but if your opponent has done something to indicate that he has very little interest in the hand, you know, perhaps he's checked to you as the preflop raiser, and you have reason to believe that he wouldn't do that with any sort of draw or even a decent made hand, then, you know, maybe you would consider actually slow playing in that situation. What often happens, though, is that people just kind of assume when they have a strong hand that their opponent, you know, must be weak, or they have an idea that when you have a strong hand, you're you want to keep your opponent in the pot with anything and everything. And there's almost always a trade-off between getting action from your opponent's weak hands and getting the most action you possibly can from your opponent's stronger hands. And the latter is usually a good idea, or usually the thing that you should prefer when you have an extremely strong hand yourself. So rather than saying, well, you know, my opponent could be weak and I don't want him to fold his weak hand, so I'm just, you know, going to check or bet very small when I flop a set, it's much more important to think, well, you know, my opponent could have top pair, could have a strong hand. I want to make sure I win as much money as I possibly can from that hand. And when faced with the choice between the two, I think it's generally correct to look to the stronger part of your opponent's range. So the first thing that I would say is that you really want to be sure that you have good evidence for saying that your opponent is weak, rather than just assuming that your opponent must be weak every time you have a strong hand. And I think that's a common error that I've seen, you know, in letters that people have written to the show and just other places, you know, in my coaching and things like that. People just tend to assume like, oh, my opponent must be weak because I have a strong hand. And that's really very board dependent. When you flop top set, it can be hard for your opponent to have a strong hand because it's hard for them to have top pair. You've got all of those cards accounted for. When you flop bottom set, on the other hand, you know, top pair might well be a reasonable part of your opponent's range, and you can often get action from that immediately just by betting.
Yep, I like all that. I guess the one thing I would emphasize that's a very basic point is information hiding, and you know, thinking about. I guess there's both a psychological point and a more theoretical point here. The psychological point is that when somebody has a strong hand, that person is sometimes tempted to think like, oh, I have a strong hand. I've been waiting all night for this. How should I play it? As if it's this, like, because it's such a one in a kind event from his perspective, he sort of forgets about everything else when trying to maximize value for it, right? And you can actually see this happen at the table sometimes. It's like they sit up straight, you can see the wheels turning, and then they do something weird that they haven't done all night. It might not be weird in a vacuum, it's just completely different from everything else they're doing. And of course, strong hands should be part of your overall strategy, right? Like, you should be thinking about putting that hand into like a value range or like a betting range, or maybe you'll have several bet sizes and you'll have to decide whether to bet, you know, the larger or the smaller size with that hand. But, you know, thinking in terms of your overall strategy, is both not doing that is both a psychological and like a theoretical failing. I guess that's the only thing I had to say.
Yeah, I'll just kind of piggyback on that. I think a lot of the people who talk about, you know, checking and or betting small in order to make sure they get action from their strong hands tend to be the same people who also complain that their opponents never fold.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when they're like, oh, I don't bluff, my opponents never fold, or there's no sense in trying to bluff these guys, or they get frustrated and they'll write in and say, well, how can you win in a game where nobody ever folds? I'm constantly getting drawn out on. And then when they actually have strong hands, they're like, oh, everyone's going to fold if I bet. And so this is kind of, you know, I think when I put it that way, it's sort of obvious that it's worst case scenario thinking, and you really want to get out of that mindset. So one thing that I tend to ask myself before I make sort of an exploitive slow play, in other words, I check because I'm saying, oh, I'm sure my opponent is weak here, so I better check and give him a chance to catch something. And to be honest, this is something I probably don't do quite enough of. But before I do that, I tend to ask myself, well, you know, does that mean this is a situation where you would bluff exploitably often? You know, as I think that it has to be both. You know, if it's a case where you think your opponent is going to fold so often that you're going to be, you know, checking extremely strong hands, then it's probably also a situation where you should be bluffing with, you know, basically all of your weak hands, because again, your opponent is going to fold so often. So I think forcing yourself to think in terms of the converse can be a good way of getting out of that worst case scenario thinking, because, you know, now you start to recognize, well, it can't be the worst case scenario for both of these things. So, you know, try to pretend that you have some hand other than the one you currently have and ask yourself, would I bet with that or not? David also raises the point of draws, and you know, it's good that he's gotten beyond this idea of that you should be trying to blow your opponent off of draws. The other thing I'll add here, I mean, Drells do tend not to be the best value targets because they aren't hands that are going to, I mean, for one thing, like when you flop a set, you're not a huge favorite against a flush draw in the same way that you're a huge favorite against top pair. So the money that you put in against top pair is worth more than the money you put in against a flush draw because a larger percentage of it belongs to you. You have more equity against that hand. It's also not a hand that's likely to make mistakes against you on all streets. So a flush draw might, you know, incorrectly call you on the flop and turn. If it doesn't improve on the river, it's, you know, presumably not going to be calling another river bet, whereas, you know, a hand like top pair and over pair might. So it's often correct to target made hands that are slightly worse than yours rather than targeting draws. And very often both will be in people's ranges. So even on a flop like queen 10 8 with two diamonds, where a lot of draws are possible, and maybe even some, let's make it queen 10 7 with two diamonds, so a lot of draws are possible, not so many made hands are possible, and you've got a set of tens. Just because your opponent calls a bet doesn't mean that you can automatically put him on a draw. Like, he probably will also play queens that way. So moving forward, you probably want to think most in terms of how can I get value out of his queen rather than how can I get value out of his draw, and certainly not in terms of how can I, you know, give him incorrect odds to draw. Assuming that you're going to bet the next street, draws rarely are getting very good odds to call a bet. Right? A flush draw with 9 outs is going to improve less than 20% of the time on the turn. So you don't have to bet more than a quarter of the pot before your opponent is no longer getting the right odds to call with a flush draw. So although, I mean, technically it is true that you want to bet enough that your opponent isn't getting the right odds to do those things, in practice, it doesn't take much of a bet to do that. So, I mean, the presence of the draws in your opponent's range can establish a bit of a floor in the sense that you don't really want to bet smaller than that with your strong hand. But, you know, rarely is a draw going to be the thing that determines how large I bet.
Yeah, that's all good. There are times, just for card removal and range analysis reasons, when draws really are a big part of your opponent's range, and I think even then people make mistakes on how to maximize value or price out draws. I think people are pretty eager to give themselves a medal for having bet enough to make the draw incorrect to call with, but I think people don't think about check raising enough because they're afraid of the street getting checked through, like in the cases when they're out of position. But people really like to bet their draws, and as you said, it's going to be incorrect to for them to call with the draw. But you know, if you bet half the pot and get called, you make some money. That's good. But if you can get a check raise in, like if the person bets 60% of the pot and then you can raise, I mean, that's a lot more. And there are situations certainly when you can count on your opponent to bet with plenty of his draws. And so I think even though you risk letting it get checked through, overall you do better to check raise sometimes. You can induce bluff three bets. You can, a lot of good things happen if you let the pot get really big. And sometimes check raising is the way to do that. Sometimes not, often not. But, there are clear cases, like when you have somebody who likes to pick up what looks like available pots and you've been the pre-flop raiser and you've continuation bet the flop, then the turn comes and for card removal reasons, the person has a draw a lot. If you check there, it's going to look pretty weak, especially if, you know, there isn't an ace, king, or queen on the board and you can be plausibly put on one of those big card hands. You're going to get the check raise a lot. And I think the sorts of people who are really, really thinking in terms of pricing out draws and that's don't consider that option enough.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it's worth mentioning too that checking is not the only way of inducing a bluff, especially if you're dealing with a very aggressive player. And sometimes people will say, well, I flopped a strong hand, and because my opponent is aggressive, I check to him so that he can bet my hand for me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that can be a mistake for a number of reasons if you're not planning on check raising. It can be okay to check raise there, although sometimes that kind of reveals that you have a strong hand, you know, especially if you don't do a lot of check raise bluffing or it's not a spot where you would do a lot of check raise bluffing. Then, yeah, I mean, you get half a street's worth of trickery out of it by checking once, but then at some point you have to put money into the pot. So yeah, you represent weakness by checking the flop, but as soon as you call or raise, then you've sort of revealed that you're not really so weak after all. So I'm not always a huge fan of that plan. And I think that when dealing with an aggressive opponent, you know, many of these are players who will raise when they have draws, or sometimes even just raise when they have nothing. So just, you know, making a regular bet, or thinking about some hands that, you know, what are some hands where I would be pretty uncomfortable if my opponent raised? And, you know, if you're still betting with those hands, then just do the same thing with your strong hand. And now that serves a couple of purposes. It makes it harder for your opponent. So, you know, now the next time you're holding one of those medium strength hands, you don't have to be quite so worried about getting bluff raised, because you can say, well, if my opponent is bluffing raising me, I know that I also have these strong hands in my range that I'm going to be able to punish him, that I'll be able to punish him with those hands. And there was definitely a second point when I started that sentence.
Well, and you make more money with the good hand.
Yeah. I guess what I want to conclude my thoughts anyway by saying, the last thing that David says is, what do you consider when trying to keep worse hands from folding? And that's not often how I think about it, at least not unless I'm playing with people who are really significantly weaker than I am, to the point where I have a very clear idea of what sort of hand they hold. I mean, there's a lot of situations where I don't know my opponent's exact hand. I only have a kind of a rough idea, and I certainly don't know what they're going to do with it. Like, most of the time, your opponent has some kind of medium strength hand, and usually in those situations, I just bet a lot of strong hands and a lot of bluffs and semi-bluffs, and I just let them do whatever they want to do with it. You know, if they want to fold, fine. You know, I don't necessarily try to keep them from folding, because then they're also folding to my semi-bluffs. And if they choose not to believe me when I'm semi-bluffing, then that means that they're also paying off my value bets. So I think that at least when you're playing against slightly better competition, the next stage in your poker thinking might be to get beyond this idea of trying to do, you're thinking in one terms when you have strong hands and thinking in different terms when you have weak hands, and instead sort of thinking about your entire range and just saying, like, look, I'm going to bet here a lot, and it's going to include these strong hands and also these weaker hands, and my opponent is mostly going to have medium strength hands, and, you know, whatever he does is going to be wrong against my range. That I think is the next stage of poker evolution here for David.
Yep. I like it.
So thanks for the questions, David. Hope you found those helpful. Our final one is coming to us from Jason, longtime listener, friend of the show. Jason said, I've been playing in a new 2-5 no limit game for about 2 hours, early Saturday afternoon on a Sunday at the Borgata. The table has been pretty quiet chatter-wise, and by the conversations, when each successive new dealer pushes into the game, there seem to be a number of regs at the table. Happily for me, the strongest regs are on my right. Good seat selection, Jason. In the current hand, I am in middle position 2 in a full 10-handed game, so I assume that would mean there are 3 players on his right, between him and the big blind. Under the gun plus 2, a middle-aged regular, fairly straightforward, who early in the game tripled up all in pre-flop with ace-king, limps, and I have 10-7 of clubs. I'm not particularly concerned about the players behind me making big pre-flop moves, and I want to get into a hand with a limper because he loosened up his play quite a bit after that triple up. I know this is a loose raise, but I feel I can get away with it if I don't flop well with little damage. I know that being too active in early position can seriously hinder my results, so I have worked hard, especially at the 2-5 stakes, to rein that activity in. However, after folding for a number of orbits, it seemed like I could take a shot. In addition, while the hijack has 3-bet a few times, the cutoff and button have not open raised once in the 2 hours they've been in the game. Under the gun plus 3 to my left is pretty consumed with his tablet and free Borgata Wi-Fi exploring hotels in Hong Kong, so I'm not worried about him either.
Can I field proof flop first here?
Yeah,
I don't like it. So first, even if you don't think they're making big preflop moves, it's not that hard to get dealt, say, ace-jack or better, and those hands will play with you a lot of the time. I don't think you're going to show a profit with this, even against tight ranges. Those tight ranges you'll often be out of position against a better hand. And they're not going to play it brilliantly, but when you have 10-7 and the other person has ace-queen and isn't automatically giving up with ace-high and is not going to fold a pair very easily, it's going to be tough for you to do too well with 10-7 suited. A second point is that if these people really are so tight and passive, as you suggest, I mean, of course, passivity about 3-betting is not the same thing as passivity about raising, but a limp would more likely be correct than a raise here, I think. If you're so eager to play pots with this person, you can keep the effective stacks deep and achieve your goal by just calling the $5. I think usually it'll just be correct to fold this hand, though, and that's what I would do, and I'm not sure. Also, the final point is that Jason, our correspondent, says that because the person had opened up his range after tripling up, then 10-7 suited became a good hand to play, but a lot of those extra hands, especially from early position, if you look at like the marginal hands, the hands that the person was not playing before and is now playing from very early position, if there are a lot of them, I think a lot of them 10-7 suited actually does badly against. So I mean, there will be a lot of better tens in there, a lot of two overcard, you know, some two overcard hands, probably hands that you're not that eager to play against. If he's going to check fold with them every time when he misses, then okay, maybe, but that's not really something that depends on you holding 10-7. So I'm not sure that the reasoning supports a raise here really, really well, but Jason owned me when I played against him, so maybe he should be telling me what to do.
I second your disapproval of the logic here. I think this is boredom sneaking in more than anything. I think people start to find these justifications for playing some hands when they feel like they haven't been playing that often. You know, I'll say a few things. One is that especially at a 2-5 table, but really in any game, you are more conscious of the fact that you haven't played many hands lately than anyone else's. Like, it's much more on your mind than on your opponent's mind.
It's true.
Most of your opponents are probably not thinking that hard about the fact that you haven't played that much. And, you know, realistically, how do you, like, I think if you think through the practicalities of, like, you know, what exactly are they going to do differently as a result of the fact that you might have a slightly tight image? As you say, Nate, like, they're not going to fold ace-jack. And I just kind of pulled up Slice quickly and put in some hands that I think they're really not going to fold to a single raise under any circumstances. So this includes, like, pocket pairs. Sevens are better. It includes some of the best suited connectors. It includes, you know, some but not even all suited Broadway hands. It includes king-queen off. It includes ace-jack off or better. And that's about 10% of the deck. And you've got six people still to act behind you. So, you know, off the top of my head, I'm going to say that's even if those six people will, you know, respect your tight raise and only play with those 10% of hands, it's still going to be close to a 50% chance that one of the people, you know, either the four players have position on you or the blinds, chooses to play a hand that they're dealt. Now, of course, 10-7 suited is not drawing dead against that range, and I do want to give Jason credit for noticing quite a bit about how his opponents are playing, and, you know, assuming that this isn't just justification for making the play that he wants to make. You know, it definitely is good that he's observed that the people behind him are on the tight and passive side, that there's only the player who is in the least good position to 3-bet is prone to 3-betting, that one of the players, the player on his immediate left, is not paying particularly much attention to the game. Those are all factors that make this less bad. Getting 3-bet aggressively in this spot is a disaster. Getting called appropriately, or just getting 3-bet appropriately in this spot, which isn't going to include some light 3-bets, is a disaster. Getting called appropriately in this spot is bad, but far from a disaster, because you still get to see a flop without having to put too much money into the pot. So I will say that although this is not a huge error, I do think it's an error for all the reasons that you stated, Nate, and I just kind of wanted to add that last bit of analysis. Like, no one is going to look down at Ace Jack and say, oh, that guy's been tight, I think I'm going to fold this. That, you know, that's just not going to happen.
I mean, some people will, right? But yeah, there are going to be other regs who say, like, oh, I've got ace nine suited, that guy's been tight, I better be careful, then call anyway, you know? Like,
or say, yeah, like, that guy's been tight, so I know exactly what he has, I'm going to try to flop big against him.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, I know he has a pair, so if I hit my ace, I know it's good or something. Yeah, some such. Okay. Oh, wait, you were reading. Go ahead.
So Jason does raise here. He doesn't actually tell us how much, but he does raise. It folds around to the small blind, an elderly gentleman regular, who the two younger regulars have been quietly discussing as capable of making fairly surprising moves given his image. This player just calls. The big blind folds. Under the gun plus two, who was the original limper, calls. And so now there is $80 in the pot. So I guess that would suggest Jason raised to
25.
He got two calls and a fold. So Jason must have raised to 25, which I think is good sizing facing a limp. Borgata takes time, so there's no rate coming out of the pot. He's got about $500 in the stack under the gun plus two covers, and Jason covers the small blind. This actually raises one other point quickly, which is that this play becomes a lot better if you have a pretty big, like, so if both you and the limper are really deep, you know, if you have 1,000, 1,500 in front of you, there's a lot more room for you to maneuver him, because the point that you made, Nate, is a very good one, that, you know, with this being a loose player, that's not necessarily a reason why you'd want to play 10 high against him. The more money in the effective stacks, the more value there is, both because there's more room for you to push him off of hands, and there's also more room for you to win big pots on the rare occasion that you do make something truly strong with your 10-7 suited.
Yeah. Although note, I think that this is the value of being in position and not the value of having 10-7 suited. So 10 high flushes go down in value as stacks get very deep. And even some straights also go down in value as stacks get very deep. I think what Andrew's talking about is less the possibility of winning hundreds and hundreds of big blinds with a 10 high flush or with like 3-7s with 10 kicker. and more just about bluffing the guy a lot or making moderate amounts of money with your good hands.
Yep. So the flop comes down Jack-9-X with two clubs.
That's how Jason beats me. Yeah. Just that's well, how you do it. If you're going to flop that well, then yes, raise the hand, okay?
Small blind and under the gun plus one check in unremarkable fashion. Jason says, I think that's a pretty good flop for me. Yes, Jason, I agree. he says, I know I am continuation betting as a semi-bluff, but I don't necessarily want to blow everyone out of the hand if they have a piece. I put out $30, which is actually a misclick, as I meant to put out $35, which would be more in line with other continuation bets of mine at the table. But I don't react as if it was an error. So good on that. You know, I think that's, if you do make a mistake at the table, the last thing you want to do is make obvious that you didn't mean to do that. At least, like, try to get some kind of confusion value out of your opponents where they're like, wait, why did this guy only make a minimum raise? Did he mean, you know? I think good poker face there, Jason. I think it's a good idea to be trying to keep your continuation bets in line with the other ones that you're making. I definitely do think at some point you're going to want to do kind of exploitive things, but I think there's not too much room to do that until you have an idea of what your opponent's hand is. So when it comes to pre-flop play and also to really common situations like continuation betting the flop when you tend not to have a lot of information about your opponent's hand yet, I'm usually in favor of keeping it pretty balanced and keeping your own range pretty wide, rather than saying, well, I have a hand where I want action, so I'm going to continuation bet small, versus when I have a hand where I don't want action, I make a larger continuation bet. That's a pattern that people can pick up on pretty easily, and that people might even just guess is what you're doing just when they see you varying your bet sizes without even having any empirical support for that. So I think it's good that he's trying to keep his continuation bets in line, and honestly, I wouldn't even worry about the part about, you know, I don't necessarily want to blow everyone out of the hand. Like, this is one of those, like I was talking about in response to David's question, this is one of those spots where I just bet a lot of hands. 10-7 suited definitely belongs in that range, and, you know, maybe my opponents are folding pocket eights, maybe they're not. Whatever they do is fine with me.
Can I say that I don't love the bet size? I would bet more, and
I do agree with that.
I think
the reason I'm okay with it is because he says it's consistent with other CBETs, but I do think probably erring on the side of slightly more than half rather than slightly less than half the pot on a board of this texture is good.
So for a lot of reasons, I think that's the correct standard play. I also worry a little bit that Jason's showing some one street thinking here. So he says, I don't necessarily want to blow everybody out of the pot if they have a piece, because, you know, he might make a flush, right? Or he might make a straight. So that's of course.
Or he might bluff them later.
Yeah, that's the thing. And bluffing gets more profitable and easier, especially given, and here's the thing, he's trying to exploit his tight image, right? So it gets easier to represent an overpair and easier to get your opponents to fold, given that they think you have an overpair, you know, with probability P for any fixed P. Those are both easier once you bet more. I'd rather bet like 50 here into 80. I think I would do that with a lot of hands. I think I would bet at least 45 or 50. Either 45 or 50, often 50. I think it sets you up to put a lot of pressure on a 9 later. I think it's what I would do with other hands. And I think thinking about how the whole hand is going to play out, you do better, especially with this hand and also with other hands, if especially given your image, if you bet more.
Yeah, I agree with that. The small blind folds to the $35 bet, and to the $30 bet that was meant to be a $35 bet. The small blind folds and under the gun plus 2 calls without much hesitation. So the small blind is folded. That was the tight order, the older guy who was capable of some surprising moves. But under the gun plus 2, the one who seemed to have loosened up his play, he has called. So there is now $140 in the pot. Jason still holding 10-7 of clubs, and his luck continues to hold as he drills the gut shot on the turn. So he picks up an 8 of hearts, making the board Jack 9 X 8 with 2 clubs. Jason now holding the second nuts and also a redraw to a flush. And Jason appropriately says, "I have caught well." Yes, you have. Villain checks, and Jason bets 65 into 140. He says, "Again, I want to bet small here to keep him in the pot, and I think if he has something, he'll call and fold his air anyway." That just seems like kind of a logically inconsistent sentence. If you're saying that he's going to call if he has something, which sounds right to me, then you don't need to bet small to keep him in the pot.
I sort of interpreted that as like, and parenthetically, if at this bet size, and given that I only bet $65, then so it's like a nested conditional. If he has something, he'll call and fold his air anyway. But he should still bet more because a lot of things will call $100, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's kind of look at the situation now. We've got $140 in the pot. We have about 400. Jason says that he covers under the gun plus 2. So let's say, $400 in the effective stacks. It's going to take some pretty big bets to get stacks in by the river, and you would probably like to. I mean, there's definitely a lot of rivers where you want to get stacks in. There are some like board pairs that you might prefer to check back, but in general, you would like to get stacks in by the river. So there are a few ways that you can do that. One is by making a large bet now and a large bet on the river. Another one would be by making a small bet now and trying to entice a check raise. This is not a board where I would expect to see a lot of check raising. In part because the opponent didn't check raise the flop, and in part because there aren't really that many truly strong hands that he could have. So I think that, and just in general, like you're probably dealing, I think the 2-5 Borgata player pool on a Sunday morning, and live poker in general errs on the side of loose passive. So you're almost always better off driving the betting yourself. I think that Now we're on the side, or I would say anyway, we're at the point where we want to be thinking a little bit more exploitively. Villain called the flop, which indicates that he does have some interest in this board, either a pair or a draw of some sort. And the turn is a really good card for that range. Now, it's almost certainly a better card for your range than for his. Like, Queen 10 could be out there, but there's a very good chance Villain has improved to something like jacks and eights, nines and eights, 10-9 for an open-ended straight draw plus a pair, Jack 10 for a top pair plus an open-ended straight draw. That 8 has just done a lot to improve Villain's range. So I don't think there are a lot of hands that Villain would call the flop with that are now going to fold to even a large turn bet. Only the very weakest ones, maybe like ace 9 with no draw. And this comes back to the point that I made in answering David's first question, which is that this is just one of those spots where there are so many pretty strong hands in your opponent's range that there's no reason for you to focus on trying to keep the weakest ones in the pot. I would probably be betting $120 here.
Yeah, that's right. I think I would probably bet 100, but that might be too small. I think it's also worth noting that Jason kept his opponent in the pot on the flop, and although that might make the opponent's range a little bit weaker, like really, if you think about what some of those weakest calling hands might be, even those are looking okay. Like a hand like 9-7, I guess probably is not folding to any c-bet, but certainly I don't think it's folding to 30, but that hand has a gut shot now. I just, even in the broader context here, I think the opponent's helped by the eight more than hurt. I think I would bet 100, but I like 120 too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that betting 120 is worth a good deal more than twice what betting 60 would be worth. You know, not only are you immediately getting twice as much money in the pot, but you're growing the pot to the point where you can make a larger bet on the river. So you know, what that means is that, I can concede that there might be a few hands, and 9-7 may be one such candidate that would call the $65 bet but not call a $120 bet. But the thing is, he has to fold more than twice as often to the $120 bet for that to become less good than the $60 bet. And I think that there's also a tendency on people's, like, people would kind of rather win a medium-sized pot consistently than win a really large pot sometimes and risk, you know, winning a somewhat small pot when they have a strong hand. But I think that that's just, well, I mean, I think, I guess you need to evaluate why you're playing poker. Like, if you just really love pulling in medium strength pots, then, you know, I guess you can go ahead and keep targeting your opponent's, weakest hands or you know, focusing on guaranteeing or increasing your chances of winning some kind of medium sized pot when you have a strong hand. But if you really are trying to maximize your profit at the table and maximize your expectation, then I think that you just have to be willing to accept that, you know, you're not going to win huge pots every time, or even medium sized pots every time you have a strong hand. And constantly, like, if you take enough shots on goal, you will win some big pots now and again. And in my opinion, that's both more fun and more profitable than just, you know, trying to consistently pull in medium-sized pots.
Yep.
Jason says, unfortunately, I was not specifically putting villain on a range of hands, nor really considering what I was targeting for a call, thinking more generally that the flop call meant maybe he paired a card on the board or a float with a pocket pair. In any event, surprisingly to me, villain raises to $140. It was at this point that I start to think about what he had in earnest. So I don't want to harp on this because I think Jason already recognizes the error here, but you definitely want to be considering your opponent's range throughout the hand and not just, you know, wait until he does something surprising and then be like, oh crap, maybe I should think about what he might have. Jason says, I didn't consider jacks are better, ace-king, ace-queen, ace-jack, as I imagine he would raise those preflop or limp re-raise them preflop. I'm a little concerned that he has queen-10, although that's unlikely given that I block it with the 10 of clubs. I also wonder if he has a set of nines or eights. In any event, I don't think raising here is the right play, as I feel my straight may well be concealed, and I thought I could reevaluate if the river pairs the board, which would be bad for me, or a club comes, which would be good for me. I can't imagine he can put me on a hand accurately. I call. I would say at this point, like, you still have the second nuts plus a redraw, so, you know, I just don't think it matters very much if he has queen 10. There aren't going to be situations where you fold as a result of that. You may end up folding a paired river, but, like, it kind of sounds to me like Jason is saying, well, he might have queen 10, so maybe if I call on the board pairs, I'll get away cheaply when he has queen 10. That's sort of how I'm interpreting this, and I don't think that's really a good way of thinking. The board pairing is overall a bad outcome for you, given that your opponent's range contains more hands than just queen 10. And so giving it a chance to do that is probably not a good idea. It could also kill action for you if your opponent has a hand like 8-9 and then a jack comes on the river. Like, the board pair is going to kill the action for you. So I think that getting, and also if the board doesn't pair, your opponent, like, there may be some situations where your opponent check folds a hand like 2 pair or even a set, depending on how tight he is. And, you know, if a third club comes, he may check fold. So although Jason says a club would be good for him, and it would be good in the sense that it would improve the hand, I think that, you know, at this point you have an extremely strong hand, definitely a hand that's good enough to get all in. I mean, you may have been colored by queen 10, but I don't think there's anything you can really do about that. So your opponent has shown interest in the pot. I don't think there's any reason to slow play at this point. I can't imagine there are very many hands that would check raise this flop and then fold to a shove. So I would just be sticking the rest of the money in, and I would feel pretty grateful that he check raised the turn and kind of bailed me out on my overly small turn bet.
Yeah, I like all of that. I'm not so sure. I'm not as sure as Jason is that he can't have ace jack suited or offsuit. Sometimes people do limp those. I think there's a lot of two pair here. Are you worried about blowing your opponent off two pair by three betting the turn?
I don't generally think that my opponents are that likely to fold two pair after after check raising with it. I mean, I suppose this might be the sort of player who's like, well, I check raised to see where I was at, and if he's shoving, then I must be beat. I don't think that comes up that much. I tend to think once someone has check raised me on the turn, he's pretty damn attached to his hand, both psychologically and financially. And I usually just stick it in and expect that he's going to do the same quite often.
I see. If he's check raising for value, do you think he's slowing down on the river a lot?
Probably. I mean, I think there's a lot of rivers that are not going to be good for him. Yeah. There are a lot of ways they could make straights or flushes even more likely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if he's going to be worried about a three bet, I'd imagine he'd be worried on a number of rivers as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think those times that he might be semi-bluffing, I think a lot of the rivers that are in fact bad for him, he might be tempted to bluff. Like, I guess I'm wondering, if I were to call here, it would largely be to tell the story that I have like an overpair, and I don't want to fold, but I'm a little bit worried. And he can value bet his two pair with impunity, or feel free to call with it. I'm not sure that's a great idea. I do think that on some of the straightening and flushing rivers, if he doesn't have a hand as good as two pair, he'll be tempted to blast off. In his shoes, I would be. So I guess that's what I would be thinking. I do think three betting's a strong play, probably my basic play here. My standard play here. I think if there's a thread of thought that could justify calling, I think that might be the start of it.
I guess I would say while there may exist hands that are going to bluff for you on rivers that are good for your hand or not bad for you, like, you know, a 10 or a 7 or a club, I think there also exist hands that are going to see those as bad cards and maybe check fold. So I would kind of consider that a bit of a wash, or I definitely wouldn't consider it like a big plus that if I call now, maybe I'll make a flush on the river. Like, my hand doesn't really need to improve. And when it does improve, it also means that the board gets scarier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I also think, I'm not as sure as you are that, I think 9-8 is one sort of clear candidate holding here. It's not clear to me that it'll call off with it. I think at least sometimes the opponent will. And as you say, just because you're not sure he's going to call off, that doesn't mean that you should just stop raising. Like, it's arguably the best way to get money in against a scared 9-8 is just to put it in on the turn. So,
and like, if there are a lot of rivers he's going to check fold with 9-8, then you're kind of letting him free roll. Well, maybe that's not quite right, but having him fold 9-8 if he's not going to make a lot of mistakes on the river anyway is not the end of the world.
That's right. That's right.
Because, I mean, it's not like he's not drawing dead against you.
So what happens on the river?
The river is a non-club queen. So now making even the queen 10 no longer has chase. Like I said, this I think is, again, like, it's not necessarily one of the best rivers because it does now, like, any 10 makes a straight. Right? The final board is queen, jack, 8-9x with two clubs. But I think this is still, like, The board is just continuing to run out so well for Jason, where first he gets the gut shot, now the one hand that could have him beat on the turn no longer has him beat. So, you know, he could still be losing to, or he could now be losing to a king 10, but I think that's even less likely than queen 10 was. Yeah. So I think we can feel extremely good about the hand at this point. Jason says, villain very quickly bets $175. I have the second nuts here. I can't put villain on king 10. And with the board not pairing, I can't imagine that I'm not at least chopping. However, I don't really think I can raise, as I don't think this villain would necessarily make a crying call with a set given his stack size unless he had the nuts. I don't think he would have queens or jacks anyway, and it's unlikely he has eights or nines or any other set, as I think his turn raise would have been bigger. However, I know Andrew has discussed the jam raise when you think you're chopping to try to get your opponent off of a chop, so I'm interested in comments about whether this play would get him off of a chop. I definitely don't think he's going to fold a 10. So as Jason says, I think it's correct that the value of shoving here would have to come from getting called by less than a 10, and that would have to happen more often than you get called by king 10. So we agree that king 10 is pretty unlikely, but not literally impossible for the villain. I mean, if I was assuming the villain had something like $400 going into the turn. If he's now put in 140 on the turn and 175 on the river, he's only got about 85 left in his stack. I would think that you would probably get a crying call from a set often enough to jam here for value, given that King 10 is so unlikely. The thing about jamming, whether it's to push someone off of the chop or if it's for thin value in a spot where you think you're very often going to be chopping, it's just that there's very little downside to it, right? When you shove and your opponent calls with the hand you're chopping with, then, so basically if your attempt to bluff him off a chop doesn't work, then there's no downside to that. You still get your money back. And here your attempt for thin value doesn't work in the sense that he folds the set, again, like, no harm done. You haven't lost anything as a result of that. The only way that you can lose money here is if your opponent has exactly King 10. And as I say, that has to come up more often than him making some sort of crying call with a set I just think you might as well shove if he only has like $85 back.
Yeah, I agree. It's also better for the times when you have King 10 if you're capable of shoving with 10-7, and just generally, it's good for the metagame to be seen jamming these kinds of rivers. So that's good. And he just doesn't have King 10. If he can have King 10, he can also have all sorts of other hands that maybe we didn't think he could have. So I would definitely jam here.
Jason says, in the end, I called, and he had ace-jack with the ace of clubs, and I ended up scooping a nice pot.
Right. Notice that ace-jack is one of the hands that he said he was certain that the villain would raise pre-flop. So that's good good honesty from Jason to leave that first thing in even after. Yeah, so I applaud that.
Now, I wonder if this is an example of one of those hands that would have folded to a turn shove and that actually did end up... I mean, I guess this river bet was a bluff.
Must have been.
Yeah. So, it just seems like sort of a weird play from villain. I kind of get the sense the villain was just like, well, I don't feel too good about my hand once he called the check raise, so I guess I better bet. Like, I don't know. I don't think villain's play throughout the hand makes terribly much sense, which was, Jason's point in wanting to get involved with him with the 10-7 suited in the first place, is he didn't expect the guy to be playing very well. So, that part of the plan did pay off here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I dislike the play on every street. The river bluff, I guess, is okay. But pre-flop,
I think you should have just shoved, though. I think this is suspicious to just bet like 175 with 85 back.
And to do it so quickly, that's weird.
Yeah. Another reason I think he probably doesn't have King 10, is that why wouldn't you just shove?
Yeah. And also, like, when somebody bets quickly, so if the person had a straight mate on the turn, he's probably like cranky about it on the river. At least he's going to think, because most people don't like actively think about what happens if they get partially counterfeited, right? And then if he made a straight, if he was semi-bluffing and got there on the river, like, those people usually don't snap that out either, right? They spend some time being happy or showboating or Hollywooding a little bit. So, like, the very quick bet, that's weird. It looks bluffy. Yeah, okay. So I think I dislike villain's play on every street.
Thank you for writing, Jason. And just fold pre-flop. We've talked about this before. You're making excuses because you're bored.
Yeah. Cold rain, tapping on my window pane.
Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.